Yoso Bhagava Alahastama Sambuddho Suvakato Yena Bhagavata Dhammo Supatipanno Yasa Bhagavato Savaka Sango Tamayang Bhagavantang Sadamang Sasangang Ime hi sakare hi atavahak Aropite hi abhipujayama Sadhuno bante Bhagava Suchira parinibhutopi Pachima janata nukampamanasa Ime sakare dukata panna kalabhute patikan hatu Amhakang dikharatang hitaya sukhaya alahang sama sambuddho bhagava buddhang bhagavantang abhivademi suvakato bhagavata dhammo dhammang namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sango Sangang Namami Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Samma Sambuddho Vijacharana Sampanno Sugato Lokavidu Anuttaro Purisadamma Sarati Satadeva Manu Sanang Buddho Bhagava Tamahang Bhagavantang Abhipujayami Tamahang Bhagavantang Sirasanamami Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Sandittiko Akaliko Ehipasiko Opanayiko Pachatang Veditabo Vinyuhi Tamahang Dhammang Abhipujayami Tamahang Dhammang Sirasanamami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ujjupatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yayapatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Samichipatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yaditang Chatari Purisa Yugani Atta Purisa Pugala Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ahuneyo Pahuneyo Dakhineyo Anjalikaraniyo Anuttarak Punyaketa Lokasa Tamahang Sangang Abhipujayami Tamahang Sangang Sivasanamami. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, freed from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Okay. Okay. Now we have the questions.
Nope.
Very good. There's not that many questions here, so it should be easy enough. Okay, here we go. First question. Can jhana be experienced with different intensity and parallel to state of mind, for praxis, or personality, temperament, introvert, creative, or combination, smarter? You wanted me to do the Q&A faster. Oh, sorry. Can jhana be experienced with different intensities in parallel to state of mind? Flat, exuberant, personality, temperament, introvert, extrovert, calm nature, excitable nature, similarly to other experience pressures? Not really, but you do have intense jhanas, but it has nothing to do with your personality. It's just that personality stuff starts to disappear. So you just vanish. So I don't think it's defined by you at all. But what happens is, you know, you just get this beautiful bliss. And while you're in those jhanas, it can be a long time. That's something which is very easy to judge, but I wouldn't even really worry about that or think about that. The most important thing is those blisses in the jhanas, the real jhanas. It means that there is no thinking. It's impossible to think while you're in those jhanas. You're fully aware, just a single object, which you're aware of for a long time, powerful bliss, and the different types of bliss of the four jhanas. And you can't hear, you can't sort of feel your body, and that all those five senses are totally shut down for a while. That's typical of the jhanas. And I've already mentioned a few times, like that guy got to hospital, and they put even defibrillators on him he couldn't feel. That's the sign of a jhana. And you can't hear anything. That's a sign of those jhanas. So, you know, those are the things. Well, can I hear a little bit? No. Can I? And I'm just, you know, following experience and following how I was taught and following what I know from the suttas. But you know that somebody once, they wrote this book about, you know, some of the main jhana teachers in our world today. And they ranked us. Who's the toughest and who's the easiest? About, you know, if you have deep meditation experiences, you go to these different teachers and to say, and they tell you, you know, what it was. And the second toughest teacher, number two in the list of tough teachers, was Par Ok Sayadaw. And you know, you go and tell him what you've experienced, and you know, it's very tough and very strict. You know, you can't have any thinking, can't hear any sound and stuff. But the toughest of them all, that's why people showed it to me, was this gentleman called Ajahn Brahm. So you've got to be careful. If you think you really, 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 really want to have your jhanas confirmed, go and see some of these other monks. Because I already tell you, you've got a jhana if it really is. I'm pretty tough on that. It's really weird, isn't it? I'm a softy on the outside, maybe. But anyway. Next question. Tears came to my eyes listening to the sutta today, though we are tracking the same path, facing the same hindrances that the arahats such as Aniruddha faced during the Buddha's time to advance in meditation. Exactly. Sometimes we think we're different or they were different. When you get to know the monks and the nuns in the time of the Buddha, you see there's very, very little difference. Maybe a long time ago, but even this morning, even the Buddhist monks in Koh Samui were arguing, and they just, basically the Buddha left them for a while. So human nature is pretty similar over all these years. And in some of these little stories which you read, you know, from in the, especially the Vinaya, people think the Vinaya is boring. It's just a list of rules. It's not boring at all. There's some wonderful stories in there. And it shows just how people are just the same 2,500 years ago and today. For example, there was one monk and he was on alms round in the early morning, and they just go, you know, wherever they feel they can get a little bit of food. They try to go to different places. So he walked behind the law courts. And then when he was walking behind the law courts, he saw the judge and some other plaintiff exchanging money. It's corruption, bribery. When I saw that, I thought, yeah, you know, things don't really change that much of what it is. And so that you see that the human beings, their natures is pretty much the same. And that's one of the nice things about the Vinaya for the monks and the nuns. It's like an historical document, because you've got the rules in there, but the rules is just, far as the history is concerned, is, by the way, what were those monks, what were those nuns, what were those people doing? How they lived, how they behaved. And that was really fascinating, given insight into human nature such a long time ago. Pretty much the same as today. My question is, can we find similes like these given in the sutta to suppress hindrances, such as 19 fear and 20 elation in some other suttas? Similes make it easy to understand issues faced in hindrances, such as in inertia. Okay, yeah, there are many similes, but sometimes those similes which they have, sometimes they are couched in experiences which they had. For example, the one about the fear, like two murderers jumping out of the bush in front of you. Now, we don't really have that. Maybe two police jumping out, a couple of bikies, but jumping out. But finding good similes for overcoming the fear, I did speak a lot about that, and also the elation. But finding some of those similes in other suttas, I'm just trying to think of some. But one of those, I was just seeing what the... Yeah, fear and elation, especially fear, just noticing the power of kindness. Because a lot of times people, when they are challenged or threatened, they usually respond with, you know, more threats of violence. If you do that to me, I'll do that to you. And you know, you... I'll call my brother, I'll call the police, and I'll call my group to support me and defend me. So often that any fear, we just try and... the simile I was leading up to was when the Buddha was being challenged by Devadatta, and what Devadatta did was he went to the royal elephant, one of the elephants, fed the elephant alcohol till the elephant was really sort of inebriated, and he set the elephant down the road where the Buddha was coming on arms round. And so this big, strong, crazy, drunken elephant was charging down the narrow street, and people were running for their lives. They were jumping inside the doors, over the fences, to escape being heard by the big, bad elephant. And as the elephant was coming in one direction, the Buddha was gently walking in the other direction for alms. And the elephant came. And the people were shouting, "There's a mad elephant, a wild elephant coming, get out of the way." And some of the monks, they also jumped over the fences. Until there was only the calm, peaceful Buddha and his attendant Ananda. And with the mild elephant coming closer and closer. And at that point, that Ananda stood in front of his master, the Buddha. As the elephant was snorting and running and right in front of them, and he said, "Let the elephant take me. I will defend my loving master." Now, at this point, it's not in the suttas or the story, but would any of you do that to me? Would you jump in front of me? Or would you also jump over the fences? But anyway, because what happened next was that the Buddha pushed Ananda gently aside. He said, I can handle this. And so you had this Buddha. And by this time, he was pretty old. It was like in his last year of life. And this very strong, powerful, inebriated elephant coming really fast at the Buddha. What do you think happened next? I'll tell you tomorrow. No, I can't do stuff like that. So what happened next was that instead of using force, and the Buddha could have, you know, even at that age, in his 80s, or just coming up to 80, that he had such psychic powers. He could have just caught the elephant by the trunk 3 times around his head and thrown him over the River Ganges a couple of 100 miles away. Be simple. But that's not what Buddhas do. What the Buddha would have done was to say something like, "Elephant, Nalagiri," his name was the elephant, "the door of my heart's open to you. Whatever you wish to do, you can pick me up with your trunk and smash me against the wall. You can squash me under your really powerful feet. But the door of my heart will always be open to you. I'll never be upset or angry at you or hate you. But you have my full loving kindness. May you be well and happy." And a real loving kindness, strong and powerful. And according to the story, within a second or two, the elephant had stopped in front of the Buddha, bowed down his head, and the Buddha was stroking his nose, his trunk. There, Nalagiri. The elephant was overcome by the power of loving kindness of the Buddha. And that's much more powerful than force. And that's, I added a few bits to that story, but I like that for fear. You don't fight fear. You understand it and are kind to it. And it disappears. What are you afraid of? So little by little, those are the stories of how we can overcome these things. And of course, elation. The reason we get elation, even fear, because we think we've got something to lose. In elation is because we think we're going to gain something. It's an ego thing. It's one of the reasons why I've often said that to get into those jhanas, you have to disappear your sense of ego and self. It's not an attainment. It's not like a medal which you wear. Have a look at the monks and the nuns. You don't know who's got jhanas, who hasn't got jhanas. We don't have a medal for first jhana, one for second jhana, one for third and fourth jhana. And we have one stripe for stream winning, 2 stripes for once returning, 3 for... We don't have any signature or medals for these things. Because this is what happens when you do get these things. I'm sorry, these stories are just too good to miss. I heard, in Sri Lanka, a special retreat centre, some years ago. And in this retreat centre, it was about, I think it was about 30 days retreat or 40 days retreat or something. But it was not just like sitting down meditating, it was listening to instructions, you know, having much more intense interviews with, you know, quite a few monks. And they would also give you tests, ask you questions. And at the end of the retreat, that sometimes if you did really, 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 really well, they give you a certificate. Now, this was, you know, a few monks, senior monks. So that was pretty sort of exciting. So anyway, there was this old auntie from the upcountry Sri Lanka visiting her relations in Colombo. And the relations there, as I was told it, now what can we do with, you know, the old auntie? We're quite busy, but we love her and we've got to look after her. But she was very, very keen Buddhist. So they asked her, "Auntie, would you like to go to this retreat for, 60 days or something? You know, we'll pay for it." Have you been sent here by somebody? But anyhow, She said, yeah, I'd love to. So she went off on this retreat. And apparently, at the end of the retreat, she did, which was really good, good meditator, good understanding of Dhamma. And they gave her this little test. And the final day, they said, we've got a wonderful announcement for you, Auntie. You've done really, really well. Your meditation, your understanding of the Dhamma, and the insights you've got. Congratulations, Auntie. We've a unanimous decision that you are a stream winner. And they gave her a certificate signed by all these monks confirming she was on the first stage of enlightenment. And when she received this, she was very angry. Very upset. I said, why are you upset for? This is first stage of enlightenment. This is huge. This is magnificent. This is a superior human state. It's a great thing you've done. Why are you so upset at us? Asked the monks. The old auntie said, you don't remember me, do you? No. I was here a couple of years ago. When I was here a couple of years ago, you gave me a certificate, which I still have, that I was a once returner. Now you've demoted me. That's why I'm upset. You don't have certificates. And you can't get demoted. It was just a little bit of a weird retreat centre. It's closed down since, so I've been told. But anyway, so that's two questions I've done. So fear, inertia, and elation. Don't look upon these things as an achievement. Otherwise it creates a lot of problems in you. Instead, you just, well, beautiful. You experience these wonderful nimittas. Enjoy them and don't destroy them through saying, wow, this is great, this is wonderful. Shh, instead. Okay, questions from Singapore. There's four questions here. Why does the mind generate random thoughts during meditation? Why are there thoughts? Because you invite them in. You choose to think. You choose to disturb yourself. When I say that's Ajahn Brahm, you don't understand. I do understand more than you know. Sometimes when thoughts came into my mind, where did that one come from? It's like all these thoughts are out around here. And I just pick one out, anything to disturb myself. It's like apparently you've got so many. How many channels do you have on TV stations these days? Or do you ever watch TV or just watch internet or something? How much choice have you got? You've got all this stuff there. And we tend to want to just pick anything. Interesting, important stuff, first of all. But if you've done that, you've thought about all the important, interesting stuff, so you've had it with that. Then uninteresting stuff. Then anything. You know, when I was a school teacher for 1 year, it was just so tiring being a school teacher, because it was the first year, didn't really know how to handle it much. It was really hard work. And since I got back home, I just made some tea and let it brew and turned on the TV when I was a young man and watched anything. I was just, I just needed just to distract myself and then energy would come back again. And I realized from that's what you do in meditation. A lot of time you choose to distract yourself with thoughts and you don't see yourself doing that. Anything to think about. And you just pick them out and bring them in. That was challenging when I realized that was true. But it was so freeing that I knew that these things weren't imposed upon me. I chose to do them. And of course, when I was very peaceful and enjoying the meditation, those thoughts didn't have a chance. I wasn't interested in them. I didn't even go out to choose any. There's just no thinking going on. So you choose them. Doctors now use hypothermia to help the brain repair when it's brain damaged. Does meditation bring down the body temperature? Yeah, I think it must do. But I don't know, because I never actually meditated with a thermometer in my mouth. And I've never actually looked at it, if I did. So I haven't got a clue there, but I imagine it probably does. I get into very pleasant meditative states, but I can't sustain them beyond 20 to 25 minutes. What can I do to maintain and bliss out longer? One thing you can do is just to that programming mindfulness. So when I get to the 25 minutes or 30 minutes mark, I'll carry on, continue on. When you program your mindfulness, you're reconditioning yourself. As for my experience, that I used to do half an hour meditations. That was my maximum when I was a layperson. But then what made me really interested in how you can prolong meditations was when it came to Waisak Day. My first Waisak as a student. That's the anniversary of the Buddha's birth, enlightenment and passing away. And I heard this incredible story. I was really inspired by it. Because just before the Buddha became enlightened, he sat under the Bodhi tree and he made his vow. I will not move from this position. Even if my blood dries up and my bones turn to dust, I will not move until I've experienced complete and full enlightenment. And he sat down there all night, and in the morning he was enlightened. And that was the story. Have you heard that before? So I went back to my room. I mean, I was 18, I was at Cambridge, I was a smart aleck. I thought, if the Buddha can do it, why can't I? And I went, actually, this is honest, I'm not making this up, I made the same vow. I got myself really comfortable. It's a Waisak Day, you know, why not? So, you know, I've got other things to do in life. You can't waste all your life trying to get enlightened. Let's get it out of the way quickly. And I made the vow, I'm not going to move until I achieve a complete enlightenment, even if my bones turn to dust, my blood dries up. And I sat there. And after about 20 minutes, it hurt like hell. But now I've got to keep my vow. 25, 30 minutes. This was pushing it, but I made a vow, I'm going to break through. 35 minutes, that's the longest I ever meditated. And 38 minutes, I think it was. I opened my eyes. And I looked at my bones, they were still intact. My blood hadn't dried. And worse, I wasn't enlightened. And there's a reason why. At the time, I never realized that this was coming from a sense of self, ego, me and mine. And it's right there, the Buddha said, there is no self. The idea is to see that emptiness, there's nobody in there. But I didn't know that at first. So I thought, that as long as you get a strong will, then you can do things. So, give up your will. Be peaceful. Don't try and get something. Don't try and force things. Just open the door of your heart to this moment. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. That's all. And then you find the 20, 25 minutes, it just lengthens naturally. Why? Because you're having a great time. Many people here who come on retreats, they don't try and beat their personal best. But then sometimes they just sit down there and they get into a nice peaceful state. A couple of hours go past. When they come out, oh, that was really nice. And the clock must have stopped, come on. Because it's 2 or 3 hours. And the clock hasn't stopped. You just got into a nice peaceful meditation, that's all. So don't try to sustain these states. Don't count the minutes or the seconds. Stay in the present moment, enjoy it to the max, and then you open your eyes and, wow, it's like time has stopped. You've been perfectly awake, perfectly mindful, you haven't been asleep, but weird stuff has happened. A few people have asked me this, how can I discern between needing to nap or sleep, that is being kind to myself, and sloth and torpor? Sloth and torpor, you can actually see that, and it's got a reason behind it. So taking a nap, give that a try, experiment, being kind to yourself. Does that work? And generally that people are far too cruel and controlling of themselves. So taking a nap and being kind to yourself, it shows you, you may just get it wrong and just be indulging, but at least you're being kind to yourself. But usually you're not kind enough to yourself. Ask any psychologist, sleep deprivation is very strong in our communities. Yeah, we can force ourselves and struggle and strive to remain awake, but do you really sleep enough? Honestly? How does your body feel? So that's one of the reasons why I would err on the side of being kind to yourself and taking a nap. And if it's really what you needed, you get up afterwards and you've got no sloth and torpor at all. Your mind is very clear, and so is your body. That's actually how it works. On the side of being kind. Dear Ajahn Brahm, would you please remind kindly to all not to bang the doors of the cottages when they go in and out? To be gentle when they pick up cups, etc., as people also meditate in the room. Thank you. That's one of the reasons why you see that there's little things like just putting a tissue on the saucer. I can pick up the cup, you can't hear it. Now I'll take off the tissue. It's simple things. And then you find, or if you like a cup of tea or coffee in the morning, how about boiling the water during the daytime or late evening and putting it in the thermos? So it's already boiled and hot enough for you. So that means you don't have to boil the water in the middle of the night. So that's what you can sometimes try to do. Can you please explain covert speech and overt speech in detail? Maybe give an example. I don't think I understand it fully. Covert speech is when you don't talk directly to a person, but you know that, for example, you see that Van Lee laughs too loud. Is that true? So I don't tell her, I tell her friends. And then so they can tell you later on or something. That's covert speech. You don't tell them to the face, because sometimes it's difficult to do that. But the point is that actually you don't laugh too loud at all. You don't laugh enough. Is that true? Is it? No, but anyway, the overt speech is like in front of a person. It's open speech. It's in the, to their face. That's what actually means samukha, right in front of them. And covert speech means, but they usually say behind their back. Sometimes you have to say it behind somebody's back at first because you may not get it right. You don't want to say things which aren't true. So you have to make sure you get it right. So you say it to somebody and ask them, is that true? That's like covert, covered, not open. Anyway. Dear Ajahn, the sutta today mentioned inattention. Is this about inability to focus? I ask, I have trouble with focusing and staying within the present moment. I've been letting be, sitting under the mango tree. It's very nice and I'm patient. It helps that it's nice. Still, I feel a little brainwashing about focusing might be helpful. With immense gratitude and respect, it's very easy to focus on something you like doing. Sometimes people say, oh, my child, my son, he can't focus on anything. Give him a computer game and he focuses really well for an hour. So it's not, are you enjoying doing it or not? So you have to put some joy into doing it, put some fun into what you're doing. And when it's fun and it engages the attention, of course then attention's not there. Which is one of the reasons why you can mess around a little bit with, I don't know what you're watching, say the breath. Say it's the breath you're watching. And so, I think I told us the first day, that sometimes you're watching your breath and have some fun with it. So, do the backwards breathing meditation. I did tell you that the first night, didn't I? You don't know the backwards breath meditation? It's one of the sort of the great sort of types of meditation you can do. And to show you how to do backwards breath meditation, now just close your eyes, just note three breaths, in, out, in, out, in, out, and then open your eyes. When you finish that third breath, open your eyes. And now, I guarantee that you started with an in-breath first of all. In, out, in, out, in, out. Because that's just how we've been taught. Now, with backwards breath meditation, you start with an out-breath and then an in-breath. Out, in, out, in. Okay, so now close your eyes and do backwards breath meditation. Out, in, out, in, out, in. With the third in breath, then open your eyes. It's actually different. You experience it differently. I don't know why, but it's true. You're messing around. Or if that doesn't sort of wake you up and make your breath interesting, then do the three in breaths to the one out breath. Now, once it's interesting, people pay attention. And that's one of the reasons why it's easy to focus on what you're fascinated with. So sometimes you can add that fascination. You don't make life boring. People think, oh goodness, you're a Buddhist monk, that must be really boring. We have some great fun as Buddhist monks. And, oh, what will happen that... I already told you the sort of gigs which I go to. One of those gigs which I went to was the World Computer Conference 2019 in Daejeon, South Korea, to give the keynote address. This is not a joke, I actually went. The keynote address of the World Computer Conference. And you asked Leha or even Christina, and I'm having great trouble with the computer, that's why I didn't bring it this afternoon. They're trying to sort of... Now, I chose all these suitors and I emailed the list, but I can't get them on my computer anymore. I haven't got a clue what's up. They're in there somewhere, I don't know. And I'm supposed to be the... And you know, you're a computer expert, Prashant. You know, I don't know too much about computers. But I gave the keynote address at a big conference. This was in South Korea. And all these incredible people there were there. So great fun. Life is very interesting as a Buddhist monk, because actually you don't have much fear at all, and you do interesting things. When I got there, they asked me, what are you doing here? I said, I was invited. And why, are you a computer expert? I said, no. What are you doing? The keynote address. Okay. So the thing is that in conferences, like in life, people don't want just to hear another computer expert. They want to hear something different. Something new. And that's why just one of the stories I told them was the discovery of the ice cream cone. And that happened in the 1900 World's Fair or something over in St. Louis. It just so happened, just by chance, the person who had the stall selling ice cream was situated next to the guy selling waffles. And the two of them talked together, you know, waffles and ice cream, totally different type of food. Why don't we combine them? And that's where we got the ice cream cone from. That's where it's invented. So like Buddhism, meditation and high tech. Who knows what might happen? But some sort of innovation can happen. So I gave a good talk there and they liked it. So much so that they gave a $2,000 donation to our Buddhist society. It's only for about a quarter of an hour talk. Pretty good earner. Dear Jambra, please explain what over-meditating is. Now it's got me there, over-meditating. I suppose that's when you over-try. You're trying too hard. But over-meditating, no, you just meditate. You enjoy it, why not? Overwork, you know, you feel tired and stressed. You meditate very long, you feel blissed out. I can't see what over-meditating is. We're never meditating enough, I reckon. So what's a nice, unless it is a nice example. Especially, I meant to tell this story because, again, there's so many Vietnamese here today. But one of my favourite Vietnamese monks, I won't say who he is, he's a Theravada monk. But anyway, he was teaching a retreat in Sydney. No, it was Victoria, in Melbourne. And you know how the retreats go? You know, we just do the briefing and the orientation by the retreat manager, and then the monk comes in. You know, we're supposed to sit for half an hour together, get everybody together, and then to give the talk. The first talk of the retreat, he never gave that first talk. He sat meditating. When it came to, I think, 8 o'clock, the time for the talk, he was still meditating there. And you know, people were very respectful, so they never disturbed him. They were just waiting for him to come out of meditation. He must have lost track of time. Came to 9 o'clock, he still hadn't opened his eyes. You know what people did? They left the room, went to bed. He just stayed there, meditating. When they came up in the morning for the morning meditation and the chanting, there was no chanting. He was still meditating there, hadn't moved. When it came time for breakfast, they all left and had breakfast. He was just sitting there, no breakfast. After breakfast, the first talk on the first morning, he was still meditating there. He never moved for 8 days. 8 days, just sitting there. He never went to the toilet. He never had anything to eat. They couldn't see any breath, but they knew enough that he wasn't dead. And when he came out from the meditation after 8 days, you know, he said, "I'm sorry, I apologize, I just got into a very deep meditation. And time had no meaning for me." And so he said, "I'm sorry, I apologize to you for not giving you any talks." And apparently the whole audience there, they said, "No, that was so inspiring. You didn't give any word instructions by words, but just seeing you there, that was just so inspiring for us. Thank you." It's amazing what happens. This is where time just disappeared for him. Maybe you call that over-meditating. But those things happen. And they said it's wonderful to see these things happening in our modern world. Dear Ajahn, is the retreat centre in Melbourne built? How is the retreat centre in Melbourne building? Do you have enough money to support? I don't have enough money. I don't have enough money to do anything. I'm totally penniless. But if any of you want to help out over there, I did that for my birthday celebration, the 70th birthday, for those of you who remember. Because when I have a birthday celebration, I know our devoted treasurer is here, but you know, sometimes I like have other responsibilities as well. I'm their spiritual advisor, I think. For years and years I've been their spiritual advisor, and many of our monks are over there, and nuns as well. And so that we came at a time they needed some extra money to actually to build retreat centres. They're very expensive. And mostly because of all the council regulations. And so anyway, I said, okay, any money raised on my birthday will be for the retreat centre in Melbourne. I couldn't believe just how much was raised on that sort of fundraising. I think eventually we figured it out to 2.6 million Aussie dollars. Ooh, that gives me goosebumps even now. Off overseas, no, not just from here. It's amazing. So there's As you know, and as you would know, our great treasurer, it's never enough. Even that much was enough. So they're raising a bit more. So there's still opportunities for you to get a piece of the action if you want to. There's always something else coming up afterwards. So they've got the building permission. They're, I don't know if they've started building. They're getting the site ready. And it'll take about a year, they reckon. Ajahn Mudito has gone over there to help out. Well, he's not yet, but he's going over there. And it's getting there. It's coming close. So don't worry about it. Just, it's amazing. People's generosity. When they see something which is really important, you know, such as like Nuns Monastery, like I'm also raising money for the Nuns Monastery in England. So, you know, there's lots of little things which I'm doing, whichever. So this is like when you serve me food, I got a buffet. When I give you the opportunities to donate for things, I give you a buffet too. What inspires you? And different things inspire different people. Okay, next question. How do I get self-esteem? From the self-esteem shop. Very cheap. One of the ways of getting self-esteem is hanging around other people who are wise and kind. If you hang around some people, they're always criticizing you, always putting you down. You know, you're not sort of thin enough. You know, that's me. You know, some time ago I figured out what this was. You know, that I looked in a medical dictionary and I figured out this is actually, it's true, it's anorexia. Look in the medical dictionary, what is anorexia? A typical definition is you look in the mirror and you think you're fat. That's it, conclusive. I know there's a few doctors here, so I better be careful. How do you get self-esteem? Look, you are with other people for certain many hours of the day, certain many days of your life, but you're with yourself forever. So if you don't know how to have a good respect to yourself, oh, come on, you're going to really suffer. And it's not worth suffering. So how do you get self-esteem? Little things like the two bad bricks on the wall, and you're going to go, actually you can't see the bad bricks in the wall. I actually found out where they were after many years. You know where they were, I should have known this. They're in the monks' toilets. Say, I'm sorry, you can't go in there. Go and see my cave, I don't mind that. But anyway, how do you get those two bad bricks in the wall? I laid that wall. I was about to destroy it because I'd failed. I thought, this is terrible. Look at that terrible wall I've built. And there was, we hardly had any money in those days. And so I had to build it, and I thought, oh, just, if people see this, they're never going to give any more donations at all, the way we waste them, leaving hammers out in the grass and crooked bricks. And then afterwards, this guy saw them. I was with him, and he said, it was a beautiful wall. I remember that day. You must be mad, crazy. That's not a beautiful wall. It's crooked bricks, sir. Can't you see the two bad bricks? And he said, yes, I can see the two bad bricks. But I can also see the 998 beautiful, perfect bricks. And I could not see those perfect bricks for about 3 months. He showed me they were there. And that wall is still there. I didn't need to get rid of it. I forgot about it for years until I wrote a story in the book. And it really helped many people. So sometimes the bad bricks in the wall. How about looking at the other bricks in your wall? Don't just judge yourself by your mistakes, your errors. Have a look at all the beautiful, wonderful, incredible things you've done. And of course, you know, we did tell that story a lot to the prisoners up in Carnet. I don't go over there these days, but the other monks do. And there's one of the prisoners over there in Carnet was really impressed with the two bad bricks in the wall. And see the other good bricks in the wall. And he apparently was going around telling everybody after that amazing story. He said it was only two murders. murder. He was actually saying that. So many other people he didn't murder. 998 other people. Well, that's really cool what he said. And he's got his self-esteem back. Why not? And that's also when you do, maybe not murders, but when you do two mistakes in your life, that's when this the cancer group, this cancer, he was a builder, and he said, all builders make mistakes, Ajahn Brahm, don't exaggerate just, you know, your errors. But in the building industry, you know, this punchline, it was a beautiful punchline, when any bricklayer makes a mistake when they're building your house, we tell our client it's a feature. And we charge them an extra few thousand dollars for that. I kind of like that because it means your mistakes make you more valuable. And that's why, to continue that story, you're in a forest. Hopefully you've been for a few walks. I've seen many of you walking, but you're usually walking with your mobile phone to try and get a good signal somewhere. So just leave your mobile phone in the cottage and just go and have a walk and just connect to the nature and find the perfect tree. And there's no such thing as a perfect tree in this forest. They're all bent and crooked and twisted and mangled and damaged and leaves being eaten by the bugs. And you find the most twisted, bent, damaged tree is your favorite. The most beautiful tree in the forest is bent, twisted, damaged. I remember telling that story to this group of clients of the mental health service, another gig which I did for mental health. And please excuse me for this word, but afterwards one of those people who went to my talk, that was in the convention centre in Perth, and they came out afterwards and they said, I have to apologise to you, Ajahn Brahm. I said, why? He said, when I saw you coming in to talk to us, you weren't a psychologist, you didn't have any degrees or diplomas in mental health. And I thought to myself, this is what they said, who is this wanker coming to talk to us? That's a really naughty word in British English. And he said, but you made us cry, and you made us laugh. Thank you so much. And so what did I say? And they said about the story of twisted and bent and damaged goods. Every tree is damaged in this forest, in a natural forest. So number one, if you're damaged goods, and most of them were told by their friends and others they were damaged goods, they've been abused. If you're damaged goods, number one, you belong. You belong in this wonderful forest, natural forest of humanity. And just that made them cry. So often, if you're damaged goods, you think you don't belong. You somehow, for well, not your fault, you've been segregated from society, discriminated against, not got the privileges of others. And similarly, the tree meant damaged goods, that number one, you're welcome, honestly. And number two, you're some of the most beautiful people in the whole world. Just like the damaged trees. Are usually much more beautiful and attractive than the others. So anyway, that really sort of touched them. There's an old problem, but looked in a totally different way. And they got their self-esteem back. They belonged. It's the same as if you see anybody with any sort of difficulty, whether it's an emotional difficulty or physical difficulty, don't just look upon them and think and look at their difficulties. There's huge amounts of goodness inside of them. And that's actually why when he went to go and see prisoners, they were a very good teacher for me, going into jails, talking to people. The first thing you notice is that they're the same as us. But somehow or other, I thought, if you go to jail, especially for a serious crime, somehow or other you're different, a different species. You know, there's Asians, there's Caucasians, there's Africans, there's human beings and there's criminals. It's like, you know, they're totally different. But then when you get to know them, a lot of times they made a big mistake. Sometimes drugs or alcohol, they wish they'd never done that. But they're in jail for it. But they sometimes feel that they are excluded, stigmatized by their mistakes. And you look at them, they're some of the nicest people in the world. Honestly. And sometimes that they can work so hard. You give them a bit of kindness, and they give you 10 times more back. And that's one of the reasons why they became a lot of really good friends in there. I remember just going to those prisons, and then, you know, the big guys, the leaders. Oh, there was this story. I haven't told this for a while. That when I went up to Karnak just to teach for an evening, this guy came up to me, and he said, "I need to speak to Ajahn Brahm, I need to speak to you." "Yeah, what is it?" And he was a very big guy. He was Irish, Northern Irish. And that was a very violent place. And he said to me that, he gave me a quick background of his upbringing. He said that he was first stabbed in the school playground when he was about 6 years of age. What happened? And he said he went to school and one of the bullies in the school asked for the money he had for his lunch. He said no. And the school bully never asked twice, but got out a knife and plunged it into his arm. And his house, his little small apartment, whatever it was really close by, so he ran out of school, blood pouring out of his arm. His father, unemployed at home, father took one look at the wound, went to the kitchen, not to put a bandage on, but to give his kid another knife, go and stab that guy back. He said that was his upbringing. A very violent city in that time. And that's all he knew, violence. And he said he actually told me he'd murdered a couple of people, but he wasn't in jail for the murder, it was just violent crimes. And he had all his scars over his body. He's a huge guy. And you know what his job was in Karnak Prison Farm? The farm was in the slaughterhouse. You know, they said they had to fight to get that job. That was the most sought-after job. It was a stupid thing to have violent criminals just keeping their hand in by slaughtering cows and sheep and pigs, and I don't know what else they do there. But he said this day they were slaughtering cows. And he told them, I mean, what it was like. They got these big stainless steel rails coming to a point. Well, not a point, just so to channel in one cow at a time. And he said all the cows knew what was happening. They could smell it, they could hear it. They were trying their best to escape. So those stainless steel rails were very strong. And he was on a little platform with the stun gun, electric gun. One shot to stun, the second one to kill. He needed to stun first of all to keep it still enough. He'd been doing this for months as a head executioner there. And then of course, what changed his life, why he was coming to talk to me, one cow came in, not making any sound. All the rest were just making, I can't call it screaming, but moaning, knowing what was happening. They were terrified. And this cow had its head down, just like I tell you, look, the only simile I can say is like you do your walking meditation. Head down, mindfully, positioning itself between the railings. Voluntary. And then this cow looked up and looked into the eyes of the executioner. He said he'd never seen any cow do anything like that at all in his life. And so he couldn't pull the trigger of the gun. He was just, he himself was stunned. And as he was looking into the eyes of this cow, the cow was just looking at him. He couldn't take his eyes away from it. You notice a strange phenomenon happen. You know how big cow's eyes are? On one of the eyes, water was getting bigger and bigger above the lower eyelid of that cow until the water was so much it overflowed. And a little stream of tears came down the cheek of the cow. And this was a guy who was used to violence. He'd never seen anything like this in his life before. And then a line of tears came from the other eyelid. The cow was crying. When he told me this, remember, because he was Northern Irish and he wasn't a Buddhist, he was swearing like anybody. This is God's own blah, 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 truth. But it happened. And he threw down the gun then. And he said, that cow ain't dying. And he said, now he's a vegetarian. If you see the size of that guy, and now that crying cow changed his whole life. Touched something inside of that murderer and made him into, this was years and years and years ago, made him into a vegetarian. The cow that cried. It happened. You know, that's one of the stories in my first book, Opening the Door of Your Heart. It was translated into German, and the German title, they used that story as their title, Der Kuh, der weinte, the cow that cried. And that actually, she's not here, the royalties from that book, that pays for Lehar's role as the ops manager in the BSWA. And the German edition is one of the most popular. It's been popular for years. So anyway, and a bestseller for years. So it's amazing. Whew. So that's actually just a powerful things which can happen in life. And sometimes these are people who think of different species, prisoners, done terrible things in their life. And then something happens to them and they totally change. Become amazing people. They always were amazing people. They never noticed it. The cow had to bring that goodness out from him. Anyway, it's 8:08. I'm sorry I tell good stories, but they're really good stories. And I've got... It's okay. Don't leave it down. It's fine. We've got three more questions to go. So shall we finish off now, or shall I do three more questions? Okay, I think you're okay. Okay. Dear Ajahn, thank you so much for your kindness. You work so hard. Oh, yeah, I just want to say. No. Thanks to Leha and Christina for looking after us so much. Much better. Gratitude is a beautiful thing. And I learned a long time ago, sometimes when people say thank you, I thought, oh, that's nothing. This is my job. That's what I'm supposed to do. But then I thought, no. Why not receive praise? Because if you receive praise, you want to work even harder. Try it out. Praise the people you work with, the people you live with, the people you're friends. Give them praise. You don't get a big heart, you don't get a big head if you praise all the people who feed you. You get a big tummy. In other words, just, you're friends with everybody. So praise is really great. In one of the sessions this week, could you lead us with a guided meditation that would help us go deeper, please? Okay, so guided meditation. So close your eyes. Watch your breath. Now come out. I did it, so I kept promises. Guided meditations are great. But what happens on a retreat is it does take a long time, and some people, they don't connect with the guided meditation. So for them, you're boring them, or they're getting a bit sort of restless. So instead, for guided meditations, there's heaps of guided meditations online. And I imagine that many of you have got those guided meditations on your iPhones. I hope you have. And if you have them on your iPhones, any time sitting in here or sitting in your room or sitting on the stupa outside, you can play those guided meditations for yourself. And so they do help you go deeper, but you get the ones you like. At any time, I may be giving a talk, you can put the iPhones on and hear a guided meditation, that's fine. I don't know what Chi Wei and Peng are doing. Are you listening to me or the evening news? Good, you're listening to me. I'm just checking that. But you can lead a guided meditation whenever you like. Dear Ajahn Brahm, sensual pleasure is supposedly bad. And you should be seeking non-sensual pleasure. Is it thus bad that I enjoy my breakfast, lunch, sleep, and beautiful views of the surroundings? They are a sensual pleasure, but they are not dangerous sensory pleasures. If you don't eat your breakfast, you are going to get sensually unpleasure, otherwise called pain and hunger. And especially if you're sitting in here, it's not just for your satisfaction you eat breakfast. If you eat the right breakfast and you satisfy your tummy, then your tummy doesn't rumble when I give my talk. And it's the same way that I eat baked beans in the morning, but if you eat baked beans and you've got bad digestion, please sit in the back. Out of kindness for others. But you eat the breakfast, which you have to... This is another thing which was really weird for me. One of the monasteries I visited when I was in Japan was a Heiji monastery. And it's a very strict monastery. That's a monastery where when they're meditating, they whack you on the back, and they have to, when you start that in that place, you have to wash in this freezing water. And it's a very tough monastery. But the thing there, they said, they always have good food. They make a point to make sure the food is delicious for all the monks who practice there and all the people who visit there. I thought, why is that? And the reason is because that if you don't have good food which you can digest, you can't meditate. You get sick. And that's one of the reasons why if you see the food which is on offer for the monks over the road there, you know, sometimes people say, Ajahn Brahm, can't you, lessen the amount of food which we have over there? There's all types of food for all types of tastes. And I said, no, because the monks are much healthier when they have good food. If you don't have good food, you know, you get quite sick. Because I've done that. I've been there with eating frogs and snails and goodness knows what else. I was told, don't ask what's in the curry. Rotten fish curry, that was a staple. Rotten fish curry, and one day I found just a jar of the rotten fish, which we had to eat. It was full of maggots. Oh. And so the head man of the village, the most refined man in the village of Bungwai at the time, I found it was cleaning up around the kitchen, I was going to throw it away. He said, what are you doing? I'm throwing it away. You can't throw it away, it's good stuff. It's got maggots in it, extra protein. And that's what we had the following morning for one meal of the day. So I've done the tough stuff, and it just makes many monks just really sick. So anyway, that's one of the reasons why have a good breakfast. And sleep, again, if you don't sleep, then again, you just get sort of cranky sometimes. And beautiful views of the surroundings. Views of the surroundings, views of nature, was even the Buddha. And many of the arahats, the enlightened monks and nuns, they would write these great poems about being in nature and just how wonderful it was to watch the wild animals jump from rock to rock and just to see the birds. And it is enjoyable because when you're a monk or a nun and you live in nature, all these animals out there, they actually become your friends and they don't jump away. It's wonderful to actually Let's see these. Some of the kangaroos, you've known them ever last 37 years, ever since we first came here. And they know you. They look at you and they just carry on eating. See the little babies. And the Joeys come out this time of year. And not just them, the parrots and all the other animals in our forests, even the snakes. And they all know you. They see a brown robe and they realise that's safe. 37, 38 years of conditioning. The animals in this forest are used to monks. And that's why it's a joy to live with them. Little possums. Not that many possums and echidnas. The possums I really like because they come out at night, they have little babies on their back. And you're not really supposed to touch them, but mummy possum doesn't mind. And they're really cute. It's like living in a zoo here. But please don't feed the animals in the afternoon, only in the morning time. So anyway, that's why these are sensory pleasures which the Buddha didn't deny everybody. And I think the reason is because you can't control these things. And they just inspire you. And also it means you become very peaceful. Watching a sunset is much different than watching Game of Thrones. Have I got that right? Seeing a little sort of snake slither along the path is much different than watching Harry Potter. Because these are very gentle animals, the real ones in the forest. And they give you a lot of inspiration and joy. They're your friends. Anyway, does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Hopefully. It's 17 minutes past 8 and that's all the questions. Yay! So it's only an extra 15 minutes time this evening. I think yesterday was bad because it was like, I think 20 to 9 I think we finished. Going on a bit late. Okay, so thank you for listening. Now we have the three sadhus. Sadhu. 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 Okay. Again, thank you for listening and for being here. And again, any question which I don't answer properly, please ask again. Try my best, but I know that you don't always understand the question totally. And those who want to meditate some more, most welcome to. And those who want to go to have a rest, most welcome to. Want a cup of tea or something? The kitchen's always open.